Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James, and this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. Grant Blackwood is joining me as my co-host today. His techno thrillers regularly reach the highest echelons of the New York Times bestseller list, and he also has a passion for sharing the secrets of his success in writing keys with up-and-coming authors. So, Grant, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Stephen. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we often teach together up in New York City in the summers, and we often get into discussions too a little bit about outlining and whether or not to outline. But I think one of the things that we do share is a passion for trying to tell great stories, and I always like hearing different perspectives. So I've always enjoyed, even though we rib each other, give each other a hard time, I love that that our passion is in the same direction.
As I often say, there are a lot of ways to skin the novel cat. So.
Aha. Yeah, it's true, you know. Some of us jump in head first and some of us plot it out beforehand. I never know what
That's
I'm gonna
right.
do and I'm kinda I swim without a lifeboat, but anyway, it'll be great because our guest today comes from Hollywood, where so often at least people's impression is that they have the three acts or whatever and the outlines and the plots and stuff like that. So maybe Michael will give us a different perspective. But Michael Goldstein is our guest. He's a producer in Hollywood whose experience in the entertainment industry began in New York at the Gotham Entertainment Group. After moving to Los Angeles, he worked for a number of different production companies and also in feature film departments. For the last decade, he has partnered with Michael Larkin to form Larkin Goldstein Productions, and they work together on features on award-winning miniseries and television shows. And Michael has lived in Los Angeles since 1995, and he is the executive producer of a new show that will air on ABC called Still Starcraft, which he just found out about this week. So we're super excited about that. And Michael, I'm really glad that you took the time out to join us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And you
now,
should also even mention that we go way back, you and I, because we developed a series based on your book that we were trying to do at CBS for a while.
Yeah, we do. And I think it was 6 years ago that CBS, they had optioned the first book in my series, and then they actually had a pilot written but didn't end up filming the pilot. So, Michael, you and I are going to revisit that, though, right?
Yes, indeed. We never say die.
Never say die, exactly. So, but it's been fun. It's been fun because over the years, whenever I get to L.A., I always give you a call, and we try to meet for breakfast or coffee or something. And so it's been nice that it hasn't just been kind of a work relationship of the past, but I feel like a friendship that's developing. And I really respect you and appreciate you know, the encouragement that you've given over the years.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. It's much more fun sitting with you. And, you know, specifically, one, I find you to be amazing and intelligent and a great storyteller, which is why beyond just a working relationship, I love reading your books. So it's always a pleasure when something comes in that is, you know, that I might potentially look at, and then I get to read it and I enjoy reading and continue to want to read more and more from the author. So it's great.
Well, no, that's fantastic and very encouraging. And so you guys can keep complimenting me for a while if you want. I'll just
happy to do
be
it.
Quiet.
It's very easy to do, Stephen.
But the passion that all three of us share is really the same, and that is to tell great stories that people cannot put down, or in the case of your stories, Michael, that people cannot press the pause button on. I mean, we want to engage people. We want to draw them in. And, you know, Michael, you've been working in Hollywood, you know, for, well, close to 20 years, and things have changed. I mean, people's viewing habits have changed. The style of storytelling has changed. Just from your background and your experience being involved in this world, How would you sort of distinguish today what it is that Hollywood's looking for, or maybe what audiences are kind of clamoring for these days rather than maybe 10 or 20 years ago?
Well, I think what's interesting about it is, you know, the terrible or the good expression of, you know, we're back in the golden age, or the resurgence of the golden age of television. And it's almost the same in the sense of people want to tune in because it's a good story, because it's engaging, because it is thrilling or exciting or operatic. And I think that has only gotten bigger and better with the proliferation of networks and streaming and all of the ways that you can now watch, and it shouldn't even be called television at this point, all of the ways that you can watch entertainment has made it that it's easier to access anything you want. It's easy, but in order to continue to watch that, in order to continue to promote that, in order to continue to receive the anything you want, it needs to attract viewers. And in order to attract viewers, it needs to be engaging and it needs to be entertaining. And that goes right down the storytelling. You can have great characters, but those characters have to be in an incredible story. And I think that's what has changed so dramatically over the last 20 years.
And the format, you know, it used to be that, you know, people would tune into a show and maybe there would be 22 episodes this year and next year, and you never knew how long it was going to go or whatever. And I was reading, I think in Variety recently, and that really people now will look at, say, Netflix or Amazon Prime or wherever they get their content, right, and say, okay, well, there's one season, it's 13 episodes, I think I'll watch that. Rather than look at a show maybe where, you know, there's five seasons, there's 120 episodes or something like that, they're like, I don't think, but this weekend I'll watch this season, this 13-episode season. So it's almost become like a drawing card to have these limited-run shows that's almost become, you know, what people are opting for instead of they think, well, I don't want to, you know, watch 100 hours or something like that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it is that availability to sit down and tune in and, you know, binge watch so much. And even the networks now are, you know, the broadcasters and the cables are changing the way that they release shows and what pattern they do. If you notice this past season, a lot of broadcast and cable shows were actually released simultaneously online. And to promote, sometimes they would release a few episodes in advance so that you could binge the first few episodes, or the pilot was released online or, you know, via an app earlier than the actual pilot was going to be aired, just to, you know, sometimes it's to promote, sometimes it's just to give the competitive run on what you're used to watching and where and how.
You know, I would say, you know, the talk about binge watching, the pretty common word nowadays is binge worthy. Whether a show is binge-worthy.
Huh.
And I don't think that was even around 3-4 years ago. And I sometimes think in those terms, you know, can I digest this television show in a weekend because that's what I want to do?
I think that there is, you know, what's funny, and I totally agree, Grant, I think that makes it great. It makes it great habits, and that's why, you know, the networks are moving away from the ratings of the, you know, the live plus same day and moving to live plus three and live plus seven. But then there's what's the DVR penetration. And you know, just that being at the ABC upfront just on this past Tuesday, one of the big selling points that they had discussed with all of their shows are the massive amount of increase in viewers based on DVR. And so I think that's the other thing, is people are watching shows that are not just even time slip viewing, you know, within 20 minutes or an hour. They're watching it 7 days later. They're watching it a week later once there are two shows that you can watch on your DVR of the same.
Mm-hmm.
That is,
it gives a whole different
really
meaning to appointment television.
Yep, that's true. But I also think, you know, and a good example of, with my show still Starcross. I'm producing it with Shonda Rhimes and Betsy Beers from Shondaland, who have Scandal and Grey's Anatomy and How to Get Away with Murder and The Catch. And they do such an amazing job of having live tweeting during the show, which goes back to trying to make it appointment television because it's such a more valuable appointment for the broadcast then.
I went to this place called the Nashville Film Festival and went to some seminars from a number of different filmmakers while I was there. And that was one of the things that they were talking about is like when they evaluate, a show, they'll say, well, how many of the actors, the screenwriters, the producers, the directors were live tweeting during the episode when it aired? And I'm just sitting here thinking, this is insane. I mean, 3 years ago, you'd never have heard of anything like that.
Yeah, but even the fact that you can measure that metric, I think, is so interesting, too.
Yeah. So it's and I guess it's encouraging in the one hand where it's like people are hungry for stories, and we want deep stories, and this new format, binge watching or whatever you want to call it, really allows us to, tell complex stories. Whereas, Grant, both you and I, we write pretty complex novels. I mean, they're not novels that someone's going to sit down and read through in 2 hours. And so we have multiple storylines, and it used to be where people were like, well, to try and take your novel and make it into a 2-hour movie or something, but now there's opportunities to take complex novels and the stories that we like to tell and really do them justice and tell them, and in this new format.
And that's going on a lot. I mean, you look at Bosch, that's become very popular, and they've taken, books and turned them into a longer viewing, episodic get-together for viewers.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of writers are kind of looking at television with a whole new eyes now rather than looking at just, can my book be a movie?
Yeah, Michael, when you look at a story, let's say you're reading a novel maybe or you're working on a screenplay or something, what are you looking for that's really going to be something that resonates with you or that you really want to produce or work with this?
I think, for me, it really has to be entertaining first and foremost. So that is good storytelling. And something that compels and grabs me right away is always what I'm looking for, because I don't specifically do shows on one network, so where it's, got a exact demo or an exact target. I want to be entertained by what I'm doing. So that's as good or bad of my own personal barometer or what I use that as. If I think I'm going to like it, then I want to do it. And that makes it really fun for me.
It's interesting. Sometimes as writers, people are like, well, what are editors looking for? What are, what are publishers looking for? And people try to write for a trend, maybe, zombies or there's vampires or whatever it is. But someone told me this years ago, and I think it's true. They're like, editors don't know what they want until they find it. And it's like when an editor is reading something, they might say, I want adult fiction or something, or whatever. But then all of a sudden they're reading, someone sent them a YA novel, and they're like, this is brilliant. I want this. And it's kind of what I hear you saying. You read it, and you have your own filters and stuff, but it's like you're reviewing, and all of a sudden, this I like, for whatever reason.
Yeah, no, and I think you're right. It's exactly, I think what's great about what you do as a storyteller, what you both do as storytellers, is writing compelling characters in interesting settings that are engaging, that take you on a journey. And if you said, we're going to take Patrick Bowers and make him in a YA setting, it would never work.
Yeah.
But you could write the young Patrick Bowers file someday.
Something like that, yeah.
But by not writing to a specific trend where you start, not, writing what you want, I think it is what comes across so well on the page and what makes a character engaging and what makes a storytelling engaging.
I like the aspect now with, and I don't know, maybe it started with Lost. I'm not exactly sure, but some people point to Lost as kind of when it started. But this idea of, long-form storytelling, really, where in one episode, might have within the large context it fits in, but it might not be about the main protagonist. Like, you know, you might, I don't remember who the guy was, Shepard or, I can't remember. Anyway, the main character of Lost. So all of a sudden this next episode might be about a completely different thing. And so you can have these multiple storylines really interwoven. And I was talking with one producer, John Tinker. I think you might have known John from...
I do know John.
He's a writer. Yeah.
Writer, producer. I think he's wonderful.
Yeah, and so I was talking with John here, I don't know, a couple months ago, and he called it backfilling. And he said, you know, viewers today will watch something, and so suddenly a storyline gets inserted, like in episode 4 or something. Well, maybe it doesn't get explained until episode 10. And then people will, he called it backfill, now I see the importance of that. I think that's a great term, but it all relies on trust. In other words, if I'm watching a show and they bring up some obscure fact or something, I'm thinking, okay, that better be legitimate and explained later. And it's not, my trust is gone.
Yeah. Makes sense.
That's the danger, the beauty and the danger of prologues in fiction is, you know, if your prologue is separated in time or context from the rest of the story, if you later deliver on that prologue, it's deeply satisfying. But if you fail to, the reader will probably not trust you again.
That's good, yeah. Yeah, that's... So there was one show that I watched. People were raving about Mr. Robot, I think, last year.
Hmm.
I guess it came out. It was... I don't know if it was A&E or HBO or something. So anyway, I felt like there were tons of promises that were made that were never kept. So I'm not going to watch the next season of it. And to me, I mean, so much of great storytelling is making promises that matter and then keeping them when readers want them kept or viewers. Because they'll forgive you if you keep it too early, right? But they're not going to forgive you if you keep it too late.
That's true.
People
lose patience.
Yeah, they'll lose patience.
Well,
I
think they also see they end up seeing the hand behind the curtain.
It
takes them out of that fictional dream where they realize all of a sudden, oh, I'm reading something or I'm watching something. So you never want them to see the magic that is going on.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the same for you guys, but when I watch a movie or I read a novel, I'm kind of analyzing it, right? Sort of the characters, or I'm asking these questions and stuff. But once in a while, there will be a book or a movie that I'll read and realize halfway through, I'm not analyzing anything. I'm just enjoying it. And by the end, I can't go back and say, oh, I know where Act 1 ended, or Act 2, or I saw what he did with the characterization. Or I'm just like, I was just engrossed in that story. Those are the ones that really, really impact me.
That is a good sign.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess it's just the nature of the business and what we do that we're going to analyze other people's stories. I don't think we can help it, probably.
Michael, do you think, is there a corollary to that? That is there a point where readers will read a book and they're forgetting they're reading fiction? Is there a way of thinking about that in television and movie terms that you all conceive?
You know, it's a good question, because what you always want is for, you know, to have the viewer come back is obviously your goal day in and day out all the time. And I think in order to make seamless storytelling, you know, particularly on TV, there's multiple kinds of television, but there's closed-ended and there's serialized. And the closed-ended things, you know, as an example of a procedural, you know, be it a doctor, a cop, or a lawyer, you know, are generally procedural. You're going to see a case, and you're going to see it through the end, or you're going to see the cop track down the bad guy and arrest him. But what you also want inside of that is that character development, that background. You want to understand who you're watching and why, and that's where I think it blends well with and the serialized aspects of it. And then on serialized television, it's, you know, really much more important than just as you're saying, you don't ever want to see the hand behind the curtain where you just lose the viewer because that story is always ongoing and you're learning. So I think it long answer of as long as you're engaging the viewer, as long as you don't lose them, as long as you're taking them along that journey so that they're entertained, or they're informed, they're scared, that there's an emotional capacity to that viewer, they'll go for 5 episodes, they'll go for 500 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I think somebody once said, we are in a war for people's eyeballs. And that phrase always kind of stuck with me. I'm like, I'm not in a war with anyone, but in reality, I am. I'm in a war against you, Grant. Well, I'm Michael. But in a sense, we are. We're fighting for people's eyeballs. And recently, I interviewed the president of a publishing company, and he was lamenting the low quality, low fiction that's being self-published so much. Not that you can't have good self-published fiction, but just there's this huge glut of really low quality, low cost stuff. And he said, and the way he said it's eating up eyeballs. And to me, it was just really, I think it's true. Like, we are really trying, and so when we tell stories, whether it's on film or on a page or on a computer screen, we're fighting against Angry Birds and Twitter and Facebook and a million other movies and videos and apps and gym memberships and everything.
Hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the 24 hours that all you have in one day is 24 hours. So
yeah, it's all we have.
Time and, yeah, right.
And so really trying to not just grab attention at the beginning, but create, Michael, what you said, is interesting enough characters that people will want to spend hundreds of hours of their life with them. I mean, it's just astonishing when you think about that. I mean, but that's really what we're in the business of trying to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing, is you are always competing for that free time that a person has, for them reading something, watching something, you know, playing a game, all of that, that, you know, there's so much out there that part of it is also just getting through all of that to make sure that, you know, it's marketed well or it's promoted well or whatever that is that you can do. And that's why I think, you know, some of it that's actually good is the ability for you guys as authors, me as producers and stars and networks and all that, to engage with social media now, because that makes your product rise above a lot more because the word is getting out there better.
Man, social media, you guys, I'm sure, are better at that. I'm not a great Twitter guy and Facebook. I'll post stuff, but I don't understand. I just don't understand it all. The other day I was looking through this one guy. He had 175,000 Twitter followers. I'm like, that's pretty significant, right? It seems like a lot to me, 175,000 Twitter followers. But he's following 161,000. Really? You're following 161,000 people? How are you not following 161,000 people? And so then you look at, you know, the one dynamic. He has 175,000 people, but that's only because he clicked on. I can't even imagine hitting the follow button 161,000 times to follow that many people. Do you hire like a college kid and say, okay, I want you to, you know, follow 150,000 more Twitter people? How does it even work? What's the point of that?
I think he's following the Babe Ruth method of social media. You know, you swing at a lot of pitches and you might, you know, hit a home run now and again.
Yeah. I don't know. These are just things I don't get about it today. I just want to tell stories. I don't want to try to get all my friends on Facebook to buy my latest book. But maybe that's just my age showing through. And I mean, it's not the new generation.
No, I feel the same way.
You do want all of your friends on Facebook to buy the book, and then you want them all to also post and tell all of their friends.
That's a good point. You're actually right about that. So Michael, think about this is something I wanted to ask you. Think about a film that, or maybe has really inspired you, or that you look at as a gold standard for storytelling. It could be a film, a TV episode, whatever it is. But I'm just interested in your perspective as someone who works in that medium, as a producer, to sort of say this show or this movie or whatever really struck me. and maybe a reason why that was so memorable?
Well, I think it's actually it's two things, because there's a film that I always look at or that I point to, and there's a TV show, and I'll tell you in the film that I think for me that really ushered in modern day movie making is Jurassic Park, because it is both a storytelling, fun, great, engaging, and entertaining, but it utilizes every aspect of modern day cinema. And I mean modern day in the last 40 years cinema.
Right.
If you look at that from the visual effects and the CGI that they did to the sound design that they did, and putting it all together, where that first moment when you see the kids trapped in the car and you hear the bounce and the big stomp of the T-Rex, and then you see the water move.
Yeah.
All of that engages your audience, engages your viewer. That is a moment that I think you only get in a theater, where it's on a giant screen, where you have the THX surround, where you have the Dolby Digital, where everything is working in conjunction for that medium. And to me, that is the gold standard. Just to me. I mean, look, also, by the way, it's, I think, in the top 15 highest grossing movies of all time also, but we'll fact check that,
Michael,
later. But
for you, that's kind of the ultimate. That's when, you know, everything started changing in movies. But for you, was there a light bulb movie that made you want to get into this business? I think a lot of authors have those light bulb books. Do you have a light bulb movie?
You know what? It's a good question. I think more so it was not a light bulb as much as the progression of movie making and television. Look, on the TV side, the other thing that I always look to is The West Wing, because I think that Sorkin did such a great job of that to begin with, and the writers and the showrunners did such an amazing job of introducing both a vernacular and a style, where that first episode is, I don't know if you guys recall, but the first episode is everybody's beepers are going off. And it's the classic version of Dirty Dozen, where you meet all your characters and you got to get them all together and get there. But everybody's pager is going off, and it says POTUS fell off his bicycle. And that was probably the first time that I think the general public saw that term POTUS. And whether or not, you know, and nobody knew it, and it wasn't, you know, nobody really knew to say, oh, that stands for President of the United States. It was, you know, Rob Lowe's character and C.J. Craig and all of the different, you know, all of the different characters getting that message, POTUS. And it created a really interesting dynamic and different way to jump in that was both familiar and yet unique and original. And so I think that's on the TV side. But Grant, a long way to go to answer your question, Grant, but it was never one thing. It was, as a kid, I would watch St. Elsewhere. And, I thought that was an amazing show that, you know, just showcased the ongoing drama and a saga in a way. I would, you know, be interested in everything all the time, from both movie making. I always wanted to go see every movie that came out. On TV shows, whatever it was that was coming that season, I wanted to keep up with and wanted to be engaged in all the time. And always wanted to be the person that knew everything that was going to be on.
That was really a great answer, actually, on a number of levels. I love how you emphasize the idea of the medium of film and Jurassic Park and those moments. You know, some people criticize Hollywood. They're like, oh, it's all about spectacle, you know, in a movie or something. Instead of story. I'm like, well, when I go out to a theater, I want spectacle. That is, you know, that's one of the great advantages of this art form. I think I heard Steven Spielberg speak one time about the Lawrence of Arabia movie and how when he saw that movie and he saw just the sweeping vistas on a giant movie screen, it really just changed the whole way that he looked at this idea of cinema, this idea of storytelling through this medium. I mean, it's like that's one of the great tools that we have for, you know, for telling these dynamic, amazing, huge stories with light and sound and everything. I mean, it's great to be able to take it to another spot. And then when you have, you know, television or a smaller medium like that, it's, you know, a lot with the dialogue and the character and all of those aspects of it that, but and I've always really liked, you know, Aaron Sorkin's work. By the way, if you know him, tell him we want him on the show here too, by the way, Michael.
Yeah, I do not, but I'm actually, it's funny, I'm working with one of his proteges who worked with him all the way from West Wing to social media, social network, and has written and, you know, started as a researcher and then was writing on the shows. And so specifically knew that he could tackle this other project because of that background.
Nice. Yeah, that's excellent. So yeah, the writing, the storytelling, just the experience, I guess. That's what you know, some people are like, oh, what movie's playing or something. And there'll be some movies that that I know are well written, but I just think, you know, I don't want to spend $14 and go see that. There's no point. Like I'll just rent it when it comes out, right? But there are other movies where I'm like, no, this one I need to see on a big screen. To experience.
And I think that's exactly, yeah, that's what you were saying before. It's, you know, competing for you, both your time but also your entertainment dollar.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you're going to go spend that money and, you know, it's not even the $14, it's you and your wife and your kids and by the time you go and take that time and then buy a big popcorn and a soda and some candy and, you know, it's a $100 afternoon. And so it better entertain you.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me turn things in a slightly different direction, and that is, what advice would you give to authors or maybe screenwriters on navigating through the maze of managers, agents, producers, and so on in Hollywood to maybe get their either material looked at, produced, whatever? Like, what would be the first step if you're some of our listeners are screenwriters or maybe authors and they've heard you, maybe others really emphasize this new, you know, form of storytelling and with short run shows and 13 episodes, things like that. How talk us through, like, what's the process? Is there a process, or is it just who you know? How does it work?
No, you know what? I think who you know is oftentimes helpful, obviously, but for authors and screenwriters, it's like anything. Like, once you're passionate about what you are doing, once you have a piece of material or, you know, multiple pieces of material, books, screenplays, television, teleplays, whatever that is, I think it's the persistence and the patience and the understanding of, you know, in order to get it into the right hands, sometimes it's a long process. In order to find a publisher, in order to find an agent or a manager and get it out there, it's really taking as many shots as possible and not getting discouraged. I really believe that the more you can get out there with something, the more passion you have about something, and the harder you try, it does oftentimes win out. It doesn't happen overnight all the time. Sometimes it takes a longer amount of time to get those things. Getting it into as many hands and never being embarrassed to hustle as much as possible and ask as many people as possible is always helpful.
It's similar in publishing, just to be honest, you know, in the publishing and book publishing world. And, you know, sometimes it, like you said, who you know is helpful, and getting to know people and build relationships is fantastic. And it's all great. But so much of it ends up being, you know, just pursuing it over and over and really looking to, first of all, take your craft to the highest level. Obviously, it needs to be really worth looking at. But there is no one route to become like a novelist, right? Grant, I don't even know exactly all your background, but I know you were in the military, right?
I was, yeah, Navy.
Yeah, and then how did you move from being in the Navy to being a New York Times bestselling novelist?
Well, it took a long time. It was, you know, it was probably 12 years before I even got published, but I think I knew I wanted to do it even when I was 18 or so. But, you know, you just dive in, and I think, like Michael said, it's the hugest component, the biggest component is persistence. You got to find a way to regroup when you get knocked down and just keep going, and you realize I'm not going to stop until I get where I want to go. And that's often a learned behavior, but I think a lot of a lot of authors sometimes think if I don't have persistence right out of the, you know, right away, then I won't make it. But no, I think it's a learned behavior. So you just keep going till you make it.
Yeah, I think everyone that I know who is, let's say mostly full-time or full-time author has come from a different route. There's no one route. Like some were magazine writers beforehand, some were journalists or librarians or educators, teachers, ministers, whatever it was, and then they started to write. Some had one book, boom, and all of a sudden things went crazy. They wrote their first novel, and it went. Others worked their way up, you know, through ghostwriting for people for a while, and then moving on to their own. So I think although the road is really varied for so many, I think you guys have both hit it that persistence and believing in your work, but also being teachable. Though all three of those, you know, belief and passion, teachability and persistence. I mean, maybe it's this way for every job, but especially I know in our work, those three together will be the keys to, I think, moving forward.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, it's funny because not the best exactly apples to apples analogy, but I always look at, you know, this story behind Michael Jordan and the story behind Kobe Bryant. Amazing natural talent, but both always said they worked harder than anyone else in order to be the best at what they do. They were not the people slacking off the most because they had such great natural talent. They were going well above and beyond, working harder, practicing more than any other teammate. And I think that's just like, you know, if you want to be at the top of your craft, if you want to get noticed, you have to be harder working than anyone else. You have to put in more time than anyone else.
Yeah.
Do you believe in the 10,000-hour theory? I think, is it Steven Pinker or Malcolm Gladwell that believes in the 10,000 hours?
You know, it's funny, to master something, I don't know that I'm not really a master of anything yet, so I don't know, and I've put in a lot more than 10,000 hours on a lot of things, but I think to become good at something, you need to have patience and persistence. I think you just do not get something immediately. You know, I'm now trying to desperately become a better golfer, in my day, but I don't have 10,000 hours of free time to be a great golfer.
Well, you know, when I was younger, I was always looking for that lightning bolt, you know, that instant transformation. And I realized that in the creative world, there's really no such thing as lightning. It's really slow lightning that builds up over a long time. So my perception of instant success has kind of changed over the 30 years I've been at this.
Yeah. How did you go from being in the Navy to wanting to write?
You know, I was, I actually tried to write my first novel when I was 8 years old. It was the Irwin Allen disaster era. And I decided to write a book, and I got about 4 pages in. And I got distracted. I went back into my backyard and kept collecting doodle bugs. So my time spent was pretty short. But then when I was 18, I read a book by Clive Cussler. And it so captured me that I kind of knew that's what I wanted to do. So 2 months after I got out of the Navy, I sat down with a typewriter and I started.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah, and then, but it didn't come all at once, you know, Grant. I think you've mentioned, you know, that it took years. And I think I even asked you at one point, you know, maybe it was in a previous interview, but how many books you'd written, and you said, how many have I written or how many have I published? That was a good answer. So have you written some that have never been published yet?
You know, I do. I have my quintessential sock drawer book. That's where it lives because that's where it deserves to be. And but yeah, I think all authors, probably you too, Steve, we have, you know, you start something and it feels good and it feels right and it doesn't pan out. And so you just have to move on.
Yeah. How do you know, though, guys, when it's just not working? Like, we all start with this passion for this story. We have this idea, whatever. The light goes on and we just start to pursue it. Is there a process or anything specific that we could ask ourselves maybe earlier so that we don't go too far off the route before we realize this isn't going anywhere? Well, how do you guys do that?
Grant, I think you're better at answering that than me.
I don't know, because for me, I didn't abandon my soccer book as soon as I should have, I think. And for me, it was part stubbornness, part passive aggressiveness that, you know, is this book really not getting sold because it's not good enough, or am I just not trying hard enough? So you have to trust your gut that you reached that point and you crossed that line. And luckily, I did put the book in the sock drawer and I got better at things.
What about you, Michael? Have you started some projects and then sort of said, no, this is just not going to pan out?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, particularly being an independent producer and having gone from, you know, working for studios and then working for producers and then starting my company with Larkin Goldstein and then starting my own company with, you know, MRG Production Co. There are thousands of projects littered across the wayside of things that I thought were either great ideas, you know, that from features to TV series to reality that you try and somebody beats you to the punch on, or you just don't have as good of a project as something else. And you have to decide what you still love and will keep going on forever. And you have to decide if, you know what, you've exhausted all of your efforts or it just really wasn't the right thing. There's a lot. And it's sad because as a producer, for me, I don't make money if we're not in production. So I end up having to separate the emotional side of it sometimes, because if it's a project that I want to do, it's something I'm already in love with. And then to give up on it or for it to not end up going forward, it hurts. It's sad, you know,
yeah.
Because you spent all this time on it and, you know, to walk away. So it's hard to walk away. And I think exactly what Grant's saying is, I think I spend a lot of time deciding not to walk away because I know I can get it done. I know I can get it done. It's a little engine that could, and, you know,
I just
got to
do something a little different.
Yep.
Right. I heard an author once say that giving up on a book for him was sort of like taking his beloved dog and surrendering him at the pet shelter. It was a heart-wrenching experience, and even if it's the right decision, he just had just a hard time doing it.
Yeah, I tend to not do well with that sort of thing either. You know, I just think of one book in particular where it wasn't just not coming together, and I was laying in bed one night, and I realized that I was starting a book in the wrong place, right? That I needed to discard the first 16,000 words and just discard them. And I was behind, and I just knew I had to do it. But yet, I sat there and tried to think of a way not to do it, right? Like, I knew deep down, you just have to do this. You got to get rid of it. I mean, and for me, I write slowly. So that's like a month's worth of my life, right? And I'm like, I can't just take a month of my life. And so internally, I'm going through this bizarre debate. Well, maybe if you do, no, you got to get, no, I can't get rid of it. So I'm not good at that either. But finally,
you
I said.
You had a full-on multiple personality disorder argument.
I know. I think we have to be able to do this crazy thing. So, well, Michael, we want to, first of all, I appreciate your time coming on. And I also want people to check out some of your projects, especially your new show. What can you tell us and what can't you tell us kind of about the show or when it comes out or, you know, maybe if there's another project that you have that's out there right now that people could check out?
Sure. Well, the show is called Still Starcrossed, and it will be on ABC as a mid-season show. It is, like a lot of my projects, and just like the way that you and I know each other, it is based on a book called Still Starcrossed by Melinda Taub. And the show is the story of the Capulets and the Montagues the day after the death of Romeo and Juliet, and the war that they go to and the power and the politics and the romance and the drama between everybody, both in the city of Verona and within this warring family.
That's
wow.
That's pretty neat. I like that.
It's pretty epic in scale.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I know just recently when I had called you, Michael, I think, you know, I was like, hey, I want to chat about a project. And you said, okay, call me. I'm in Madrid or somewhere. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
But you guys were working on the pilot over there, and that's pretty exciting. And so we
great.
Definitely,
Yeah, we spent 3 weeks filming all over Spain, so in Madrid and Caceres and Plasencia and Salamanca and Toledo, where we had just the most amazing locations and opportunity to capture so much more. And it's hard to recreate Shakespeare's 16th century Verona anywhere but there. We locations scattered all over the world. And when you would actually think, oh, well, why don't you just go to Verona? Well, if you look, first of all, the fact of the balcony and the size of the streets, it looks like you could stand on your tippy toes and get to the Juliet balcony. But at the same time, what we realized is, you know, in order to give it this great vision, is what you don't want to do is spend more time and money on the visual effects and post of wiping out phone lines and air conditioning units and satellite dishes. And so going to these lovely Renaissance towns that are so well preserved in Salamanca and Caceres and Plasencia was just an amazing opportunity and gave us this great big scope and scale that, you know, you couldn't get anywhere else in the world. And we checked out there, Italy, we checked out Prague and Budapest, and we looked and Italy, as I said, Spain just came up and, you know, was fantastic for what we needed, and we'll be filming the series there as well.
Well, that is pretty cool. I love it. I love to hear success stories, especially when people that I respect, you know, have been passionate about a project and see things start to come together. So I look forward to watching it. And, of course, we want all of our listeners to definitely check it out. Michael, is there a place online where people could either be in touch with you or maybe find out about your new projects? Do you have a website or a Facebook presence or Twitter?
Yeah, well, all of the above. It's funny because with my new company, we are actually just setting up the website now because there was, you know, all of a sudden this flurry of announcements on the new show that, you know, and the new company is the MRG Production Company or the Mr. G Production Co., where my old company, Larkin Goldstein Productions, has a lot of information about me and has a website and a way to reach me via email. But, I tweet, I have an Instagram, I have a Facebook.
What's your hashtag on Twitter, Michael?
That's a good question. My Twitter name is Michael Goldstein. Because I go so far back on actually registering for Twitter, but never really sent any tweets out. But
cool, nice.
That I somehow managed to join Twitter before they allowed you to type in a full name. but it is literally at Michael Goldstein without the N.
Cool. Without the N. And Michael. Is there a Facebook? Because I have the sense if I put Michael Goldstein in, I might get a lot of Michael.
Yeah, there's a million. There's not an official Facebook page for me. It is just my actual Facebook of friends and family. And
oh, I got you right on.
So, but yeah.
But maybe in the future there will be something to.
Yes, I'm sure. Once we get closer to the show airing, I think it will have to be an official website for that and Facebook for me. But, you know, and beyond that, you know, I also just had a Hallmark movie that aired recently called October Kiss, which was a wonderful Halloween movie. And I have another two television movies coming up on the Hallmark Channel in the next year. And those will be underway soon. So I, you know, worked on a whole lot of different mediums.
Yeah, excellent. Well, good. And so, Michael, thanks for coming on. And Grant, I appreciate you jumping in to co-host with me. Grant, tell us about your latest book or where we can reach you online, too.
I'm at grantblackwood.com, and my newest book, which is the latest in the Jack Ryan Jr. Campus series, is out June 14th. It's called Duty and Honor.
So we want everyone to check that out. If you haven't been reading Grant, you need to. You need to check him out. Info on my books is at stephenjames.net, and I am taking registrations now for our next Novel Writing Intensive in Dallas this fall. You can go to novelwritingintensive.com. And, of course, for more info about our guests and to check out other broadcasts, click to the storyblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.